It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 293 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week is another doubleheader as I have two great interviews that I want to share with you. First up is Rich Tomaso from Image Comics, who's doing a really fanciful and wonderful book called Spy Seal. We talk about how this came to be and how far back in his experience the seeds for this were sown. Then everything wraps up with Sam Johnson giving us an update on Geek Girl, and he has a Kickstarter going on right now, which will end this Thursday, August the 10th. To support this book, be sure to go to Kickstarter.com and look up Geek-Girl. Sam also gives other ways that we can keep track of the good things that he's up to during the interviews, so I'm sure you're going to want to listen to what he has to say. There's a lot to get to this week in the podcast, so let's get to it. I'm happy to welcome to the podcast Rich Tomaso, creator of a really fun comic that's got kind of a, I'm not exactly sure how to classify it, but it's called Spy Seal. How are you doing, Rich?
Great.
How would you classify Spy Seal? Is it a, I'm not exactly sure how to categorize it.
It is kind of odd because it does kind of, it's pretty inspired by Tintin. It's like the big inspiration that's been kind of with me for years here and there, but I think it's pretty heavy in this one. Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, anthropomorphic animal cartoon characters, but it doesn't feel like I'm writing them when I'm writing the story. Someone was asking me, like, oh, do you think a lot about, like, what animals you choose for the characters? And I said, no, not really. I mean, unless it's just like, okay, we have a pilot and maybe they should be a bird, that kind of thing. I don't really think about the appropriateness of the animal to the character. Maybe I should think more, but
Maybe it's better you don't think about it because it comes natural that way.
And it's a cartoony, you know, it looks cartoony. That you're looking at anthropomorphic characters, but it's this, you know, this espionage story. So yeah, it's kind of odd. It's definitely not Velvet because it's not realistic. But I'm not trying to write it unrealistically.
Well, why don't we first talk about your background, because I think that'd be good to help people understand, because you're doing something a little different this time compared to what you've done recently. I'll read from Image Comics. I'll read a little paragraph that they have out there about you, and you can comment on it and say if they're right or wrong, or if there's something they should have added or not. Inspired by the crime and horror films of the 1970s to 1980s, artist-writer Rich Tomaso has effectively utilized those influences in his first two original titles at Image, Dark Corridor and She-Wolf. Having grown up during these time periods, he's also been able to draw from his own life experiences to elevate and personalize his comics while simultaneously working within those classic genres. Anything you want to add to that?
No, that's pretty right on. I for a long time I was a cartoonist who either did autobiographical comics or slightly fictionalized autobiographical, and I really couldn't get at anything. I really couldn't get at anything filled by doing that. I felt like every time I approached a subject, it was a subject that had been done many times over by other cartoonists like Robert Crumb or Jaime Hernandez, and I felt like I couldn't really have a unique voice just off of drawing off of my own life. And I feel like somehow within these genres, I'm able to talk about personal things a little easier. It's kind of odd. Like, I always think I'll always go into these things with a movie. Like if it's a crime comic, I'll always be thinking of some noir film or some crime novel that I really like. when I get into it, it's kind of surprises me how much of my personal experiences, things that have happened to me in my life, things that I want to personally express, go into these stories. It's always strange. I'm like, well, how come I can't just do that straight out? For some reason, I can talk about things like that a little better underneath another story, when it's a layer underneath a crime story or horror story. Yeah.
Well, I always have to ask, when somebody says they're an artist writer, and you can tell me which one where you fall in this. Are you an artist who likes to write? Are you a writer who likes to do art? Or are you a storyteller, as a lot of people tell me these days?
I think I'd be an artist that likes to write. You know, an artist that likes to write his own comics, because even as a kid, it kind of was all about the art for me. Even in high school, I used to draw and write full comic stories, but if I tried to read those now, I know I'd just cringe, because really, I just wanted to draw comic books, but I wasn't really thinking about the writing side of things. I would just come up with some, you know, simplistic idea and follow and just kind of make it up as I went along. It took me until after college to really seriously think about the writing aspect of these comics that I wanted to do wholly by myself, you know.
That's interesting. What was it that made that transition happen, that you decided you liked to write as well?
I think the thing was, I in high school, I wasn't really, I was kind of reading, you know, funny animal cartoon, a lot of like anthropomorphic cartoon comics. I went to high school in the mid 80s, so it wasn't really anything that I found that was very challenging. And at the end of my art college, after the first year, I dropped out and I discovered Love and Rockets, and it just blew me away. I'd never read anything like that. I had known who Robert Crumb was. I had known of some of these guys who preceded the Hernandez brothers, but never read their stuff. For some reason, it was the artwork that kind of drew me to Love and Rockets. But when I got the collection, the Death of Speedy, and when I read that, I was just completely blown away, and I thought, wow, I have to really rethink all this and really try to come up with some more interesting material for the writing.
Now, it says here in your bio that you had done Dark Corridor and She-Wolf for Image. Were those your first two comics, or did you write more or create more before that?
No, I had been doing comics for about 20 years before that. I had started with Fantagraphics books back in 94, actually with Eros Comics. I did a comic called Animal Porn, which is like this retelling of the Dracula story in the 90s. And then I started doing stuff right after that. It was like a 3-issue miniseries. Right after that, I started working for Fantagraphics.
Okay, now, Dark Corridor and She-Wolf seem a little more serious, or a little darker in nature, maybe I should say, as opposed to your current book. Was that intentional? Had you done dark for a while and you wanted to go and do something a little lighter?
Yeah, I thought, because Spy Seal is actually a character I drew as a kid. I came up with him, this character, when I was like in 6th or 7th grade, and I would draw comics of him, and I thought, well, maybe I'll kind of keep it the way it was. Maybe there's no need to make it like super violent or super serious for like an adult audience. Well, maybe I can keep it kind of as a lighter comic like it was when I was a kid. And again, I was rereading kind of the Tintin books to get an idea of what I wanted to do with this. This character and with these stories, and I thought, you know, this is really sophisticated comics, and it's one of the, you know, Tintin's one of the few young readers material that can really hold my interest as an adult. It just kind of travels around the globe, and just a lot of interesting stuff going on. Plus, I think he gets away with things that you wouldn't really get away with in a kid's comic these days. And I thought, yeah, let me try to ride that line and this. You know, this comic doesn't need, I don't think it'll gain anything from being, you know, profane, from having profanity or extreme violence or anything. So let me try to do something that could appeal to a bigger range of readers.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we meet the main character who is going to become the Spy Seal, he's actually unemployed. So this is, on some levels, kind of an origin story.
Yeah. I thought it'd be interesting to start with his life before he goes into this kind of work. And he's mainly a field agent. I mean, again, like James Bond, a lot of those adventurous kind of characters, is a field agent. So I've got him. His politics aren't far to the left or far to the right. He kind of can understand his enemy and where his enemies come from, because I thought it was interesting that he did start out homeless. He does have that. He has this conversation with his friend about how the government's like, well, you know, you have these people who are against our own government because they're not really for the working class. And you know, it's kind of like the capitalism is really becoming ethos of this country. And so he's grown up in England. His family's there. So he's kind of like, he's working for the British government, but he doesn't always see politically. He doesn't always see eye to eye with them. He can kind of understand where governments like the communist governments like Russia, he can kind of understand where they're coming from.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought it'd be interesting to have a character like that that's not so to the left or to the right, you know.
Mm-hmm. And when he starts out, he really doesn't have any goals in mind. The only thing he wants to do is get a job, apparently.
Yeah.
I found interesting. He doesn't know what to do with himself. And I wish that real life was like this a lot more, was that things kind of fall into place for him as the book progresses.
Yeah. Just as a matter of getting caught up in the middle of some international dispute, and the way he kind of handles himself in this conflict that happens in his hometown, luckily he falls into this job. A lot like the way a character, they wouldn't really necessarily become employed, but in the Hitchcock's movies, you always have that character where they're just this ordinary guy, they're this man off the street, and they kind of get pulled into this, pulled into like an espionage or crime situation by accident.
I'm always remembering that they thought that James Bond should look like an ordinary guy. You know, he shouldn't be a great-looking guy who would stand out in a crowd. He should be sort of average.
Sure, yeah.
So I like that about it. Now, what's the main character's name for people who get to know these things?
Oh, yeah, Malcolm Warner is his actual name. It's Spicel's actual name.
Mm-hmm. And the girlfriend's name is Sylvia?
Sylvia, yeah, this artist friend. Yeah.
I always get a kick because he's there. They go to an art museum, and when they go there, something unexpected happens. They're looking at stuff, and the two of them get separated, and it looks like a rabbit, a female rabbit, comes up and starts talking to the seal. And she sort of has a sounds like a European accent. Some extent, and she wants to hang around with him and doesn't make it real clear why, and he kind of well, okay, that's perfectly fine, while the girlfriend looks on and is not very pleased with the situation. Which I like.
Yeah, it's very much an idea that came from Alfred Hitchcock's 39 Steps. His character just kind of latches on to the main character. Just, I think, is just out of the theater, and this woman just kind of latches onto him instead of some kind of bodily cover for herself. She knows she's going to get involved in something that's going to involve a gunfight of some kind.
Yeah, well, that comes before too long at all. I mean, the one great thing about it, there's discussion that goes on, but it doesn't last long before some action and stuff starts to happen. And there are two like foxes that start doing some sort of impressionistic dance. And in the middle of it, things start to go awry, and poor old Sylvia gets winged by a bullet that goes flying by. And then what's really interesting is the way that our seal friend jumps into action to defend her. I got a kick out of that. And then he actually takes down one of the two foxes, apparently.
Yeah.
Which is something great. So, and Are we going to find out how he got to the place where he could do these kinds of things?
Yeah, I'm hoping to do some more with these characters. I'm hoping that I can do more than just his first story arc and then kind of go into his background a little more, because he does have a military background, which he hints at a couple of times in the first series. But yeah, hopefully I can go into that some more. I would love to get into different time periods. You know, it'd be really interesting. Maybe even see him at some point, like a earlier book where he's in the military, or have something to do more with that kind of background of his. Yeah, hopefully as the books go on, we'll get more and more about his background. I can keep this thing going for a while.
So as things progress, of course, they suddenly get involved with MI6. And of course, I've always got to ask, you know, I understand James Bond's in the UK, and a lot of spies and the spook show over there goes. Is it more fun to tell a British spy story than, say, an American one?
I think so. I think it's just that it's kind of like classically told in Britain. I feel like other countries too, and like there are films that are made in other parts of Europe, and it seems like most of the time when they do spy movies, they're set in Britain, and it's like, wow, that's funny, because they could have done the story set, you know, in Germany or France, but they always end up setting them in Britain because there's such a long history of spy novels, and they have such a long history of real life agents that have had kind of amazing careers too. Just seems to be the place to draw from.
Now, I don't want to spoil too much about what happens in the book, but let's just say things get to a point in which we can probably let go. This is the first issue of a series. How many are in the series?
So the first series is four issues long.
It's got a subtitle, right?
Yeah, it's the Court and Steel Phoenix.
Yeah, and we see something that alludes to that in the first issue, which is kind of fun. And the interesting way that you tell it is kind of fun for me, because there's sometimes we don't exactly know who is what and what's exactly happening around. And we have to kind of figure out, like he does, what's taking place. And I like that in the story. I don't want somebody to go around wearing a big badge that says MI6 on it or something like that. I want to see things develop as things go on. We get to see different characters, get to see different personalities, and it's kind of fun to look at these things and to get to know them, you know, all of us at one time. Basically, you're helping those of us who are reading get to know them as well as you're presenting them. So it's fun the way you do that.
No, thanks. Yeah, and every issue people will be introduced to new characters the way the story runs. And I think every issue goes to sort of a different place for every. In every issue, you're in a completely different part of the country, part of the world. So, had to travel around a little bit. So.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of like I can't remember the name off the top of my head, but the American spy show movie that goes all series that goes all over the world. You know, you end up in different places. He's in Germany one time, then he goes to France, and then he goes to. You know, I can't remember. I shoot myself for not remembering the Bourne stuff.
Bourne trilogy, Bourne Identity.
Yeah, so all these influences are kind of coming to bear in your book. Did you like the Bourne movies as opposed to Bond, or did you favor Bond? How did you feel about these things?
I actually like the Bourne stuff a little more. The newer James Bond stuff is interesting. I find those movies really interesting, but when I went to look back at the Bond movies that I watched, like in the 70s and 80s, I couldn't get into them at all. I actually got very little ideas from them. I was surprised. They were just too fantastical. I couldn't really get anything from them. I got, you know, definitely more from reading some books and watching the James Licari movies are really great, especially Tinker Tailor, Soldier Spies. Excellent. Those gave me a lot better ideas on what to do with these characters and stories than anything else. And it was hard because I've never really, as an adult, you know, doing this for now, 24 years, I've never done a spy comic, I realized. So it's fun. It's a whole new territory for me.
Mm-hmm. And very different. Like, it's got a little more of a cartoony feel than, say, the other books might have. So it actually works well within the process, because it's a little more than, say, everyday life. So that cartoon kind of makes us feel like something unusual might happen as we read the book.
Yeah, definitely. Something more exotic going on there. Mm-hmm. Fits right in with them. Mm-hmm. Setting all over the world.
So. So why call it Spy Seal? I'm curious about that.
Well, that's the thing. That's what I called it when I was 13 years old, and I had drawn this picture and put it on Facebook, and it's like, oh, this was a character I did when I was 13, Spy Seal, and everybody really liked it, and no one ever said anything about, like, the title. Like, I wanted Image or anyone had suggested I call it something else. I mean, I thought about calling it British Agents, which is what I changed the comic to. When I got into high school, I started doing a comic strip based on the comic book that I had done a couple of issues on, and I changed the title of British Agents, but no one really said, like, oh, no, you should change the title to something else. They were like, no, that sounds good. It's Spy Seal. So, yeah, it's kind of funny. I would never think that would be a legitimate comic or comic book title of something that I would do, you know, as a professional, but people really like it. I'm enjoying working on it too. It's been a lot of fun to work on.
I like the subtitle of the series. This is Britain's Slickest Secret Agent.
Yeah, like that was the tagline I came up with at the last minute. I needed something above there, I thought, and I said, oh, I just kind of typed that out, and I was like, oh, that's great.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of fun. I like that. About the character. So we got four issues in this initial group. Yep. Based on how these do, you'll go on and do other stories?
Yeah, I'm hoping it. I'm hoping it does well, so I can go on. I Dark Corridor was something I wanted to do for a while. I kind of wanted to continue that story a little longer, but the sales just weren't there. So, this, you know, my current comic, it seems to be getting a lot of attention before the fact, which I didn't have with She-Wolf and Dark Corridor. We really had no idea how they were going to do, because there wasn't really any initial response, of course, because no one was reading it. But just doing these little kind of illustrations of Spy Seal over the past 6 months and putting stuff on the web and seeing a lot of attention, seeing a lot of people excited about it, I kind of have a better idea of how well this will do as opposed to the other comics. So, yeah, hopefully I can do this for a while.
Now, writer-artist, or artist-writer, however you want to put it, did you do everything in this book, or were there something you didn't do because you didn't feel you were good at it? Or is this basically your thing from start to finish?
I did the whole thing, yeah.
Wow. Logo, fine. Color?
Yeah. Color and hand lettering and all that stuff. That's everything myself, which is, again, makes it hard to do it all myself. But, yeah, I just kind of have a vision for it and want to be able to do it exactly the way I want it to be.
So how long does it take to do an issue from, say, concept through?
It takes me about 30 days to do an issue. So the issues are about 20 pages. So it takes me a while to write. You know, it'll take me about a week to write the story, flesh out the story, and then thumbnail it out. And then it takes me a while to do it. But I can usually do a whole page in a day, but I can't do the coloring, like, at that point. It takes me a long time just to draw the pages, and so I'll always do the coloring on the following day.
Mm-hmm. So is this going to be monthly now going forward?
Yeah. It's going to be a monthly book that starts on August 16th is the first issue.
Okay. Second issue, like, a month after that, basically, like, say, the 16th of every month?
Yeah, around the middle of each month, they'll come out.
Oh, good. That'll be good. It's kind of fun. So I highly recommend this book. I think it's something a little different, which is kind of fun. I get tired of Long John stuff week after week after week. So it's nice to read something a little different. And you're right about a seal being something that we haven't seen much. Most of these kinds of characters tends to be like, if you're going to do anthropomorphic, they try to be like a fox or a horse or something. I don't know. The seal was an unusual choice.
Yeah, a lot of ducks out there, too.
That's true, that's true. Disney favors the ducks and the mice and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So it's all kind of good. So, okay, well, I mean, basically, when you were a kid, did you come up with all these stories, or did this kind of come over time as you got all these stories in mind? How did you develop them?
Yeah, I think as a kid, I just kind of made up the stories as I went along. They were very close to what I watched on Danger Mouse. Danger Mouse was like a favorite cartoon and TV show of mine when I was in seventh and eighth grade. They were basically me making my own Danger Mouse comics, but with a different character. You know? And now, as I'm getting to the middle, about the towards three quarters of the way through this first Cord and Steel Phoenix, I'm starting to get ideas for what I'll do next for this series. So
you've got, granted, you got the anthropomorphic things, but then you've got realistic things on many levels, but not a lot of dark shadows or anything like that. It's largely as if everything is well lit. Is that kind of, you like your art that way? Is that the way you prefer to do it?
That's kind of, people had mentioned that about Dark Corridor too, that it was so bright and colorful. And I thought, I always thought about doing crime comics that way, especially if I'd ever gotten, that was the first time I ever did anything in full color. And I thought, you know, every crime comic has the dark shadows and really dark colors, and it's been done to death. And I thought, you know, why not just do it a different way? It was supposed to have kind of like a 70s like look and feel sensibility to it, you know. So I thought, you know, I'll give it that kind of.
And the Tintin kind of coloring to it as well.
Oh, definitely for this one. I've kind of like muted down those colors. I color them, I can't help but do kind of very vibrant, bright colors. But when I'm done coloring a Spy Seal page, I'll reduce the opacity down a little bit, so the colors are a little lighter.
Really cool. Now, when they get done, are you going to collect them into a trade? Is that what's going to happen?
Oh, yeah, I've got that planned out, and I've also got a completely different cover plan for that, because, again, I want the covers to kind of have that same feel that the Tintin covers have, and the comic books don't have that. They just have, like, a completely different layout to them, and I thought, oh, it would be interesting to just have the, instead of just using one of the covers from the series for the trade, I decided I'm going to do a completely different one for the trade. That works better for a book, for a trade.
Now, I gotta say, this thing screamed out like the late night cartoon network stuff. I just felt like this could be a very easy fit into those kinds of shows. You know, the Family Guy, the other things that go on late night on Cartoon Network.
Yeah.
Do you think that would work there? If somebody would approach you about doing a late night cartoon show with this, would that be something that would interest you?
I mean, that would be great. Yeah, I definitely could see it over at Cartoon Network or Nickelodeon or something like that. I think that would be awesome. I did have one person ask me about that. There hasn't been anything continuing on that front as of yet. Someone did ask me if they could show it around to some of their clients at Paramount. Oh, yeah, sure. That was before I even started the comic. I was just putting little illustrations online. That'd be amazing.
It'd be so fun to see this stuff, because this just fits perfectly into the kind of things they're doing. So I think it'd be a great thing to do that. Now, of course, Spy Seal, I guess the She-Wolf and Dark Corridor, they're done for now, or will we see more of those?
Yeah, those other two comics are done for now. I may return to She-Wolf at some point if I have a chance. But for now, I'm just kind of hoping I can keep going with Spy Seal and do some more adventures with him.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Are there other projects you're working on that we ought to be aware of?
No, not right now. Just putting everything into this one series for now.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any idea how many stories you want to tell? Or is that kind of up in the air?
It's totally up in the air. Right now, I'm still concentrating. The first story I don't really tell you exactly what time period we're in, but it's basically would basically be like the 60s era of the Cold War, and I'm still thinking about that time period and other stories I'd like to tell. So I've got a couple of other things that would that I thought would be great for stories told in that same general time period of the Cold War. So hopefully I can at least get to those other two. That'd be great.
You see, the great thing about that time period is you don't have cell phones, you don't have Wi-Fi, you don't have ways to contact each other instantly. You have to stumble on the things or talk to people in order to get information, which I always think is a much more fun way to do it. You know, when I started watching The X-Files, that was the first show, and I really noticed the cell phones on there. They were constantly just talking to each other all the time. And I thought, you know, that's kind of ruins the fun of it all. You know, you get
to... Yeah, it's so easy for someone to get someone else out of a situation, like, immediately with the phones, you know. Without that, you have to kind of be more creative on how that information is going to get across from one character to another.
Mm-hmm. You have to plan ahead. That's what you have to do. See, a cell phone to me is just an easy out.
Yeah.
You get your thing done, and all of a sudden, it's often right in the middle of a conversation, there'll be a phone call. So you don't get a chance to ever really explore the whole situation. You kind of leap from the middle of one conversation to another right away. So I like it better the way you're doing it.
Thanks. Yeah, it's more fun, definitely.
Do you like also the artwork and the sensibilities of that time?
I do. I really do love a lot of the 50s comics. We were talking about Disney, and I really like Carl Barks' Donald Duck and Uncle Scrooge comics. I just love the clarity of his line and really simple look of it.
Yeah. Very cool, very cool. Well, I'm going to be curious. Do you know what the next set's going to be, or is that something that's going to be on hold until we see how the first set does?
I'm really interested in doing something about the space race. I've just slightly mentioned this in another interview. I don't really have a whole story, but I feel like that's really where I'm gravitating towards. No pun intended, but yeah, I do think that would be kind of an. I was thinking about how that could make for an interesting story, so that might be something like that for the next series.
We got a whole decade of things to pull from, all kinds of craziness that went on in that time period, that a lot of us have probably forgotten or never knew about. That gives you all this way to, like, as if this is brand new and you're touching it for the very first time, for as far as some folks go.
Yeah, and I think people, even in this kind of business, some people, I think it depends on the age, I would think a younger character, but there are a lot of people, it's a time period where people are looking inward too, and I think that's really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it's a great character. I'm going to be fascinated to see how this all spells out and how you tell his origin story. And, you know, you'll probably tell a little bit how he got to where he was at the start, too. So that'll all be fun to see how you do that. I like a story that tells the background and gives us an idea where things are and where they might go. So I'm really excited about what you're going to do. I can't wait to see issue 2.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, issue 2 is really where things get exciting as far as that stuff goes, as far as that action stuff goes. Start to find a little bit more about what's going on in the, you know, as far as who they're chasing after. So
it's called Spy Seal, and the first issue will be out Wednesday, August 16th, and then about a month, roughly, each month after that, or the same time of the month. So I think it's great looking stuff, Rich, and I'd like to see the more issues, and I hope you get to tell these stories for a long time.
Yeah, me too.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, from flesh and blood, I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
It's always a pleasure to talk with Sam Johnson, the creative force behind Geek Girl and many other good things. How's it going, Sam?
It's going good, thank you, Wayne. How about you?
Good, good. Why don't we get the update, because I understand you're in the middle of a Kickstarter for the collected edition of Geek Girl. Do you want to give some specifics on that?
Yeah, so, I mean, basically, I haven't done Kickstarter before. Initially, the idea was to do it to my publisher. The publisher, Marcosia, wanted to have my order for how many copies I wanted to individually order of the collection. And rather than just pick a number out of the air, I thought I'd set that up to get pre-orders. And then I put more stuff on. And we've just added now, there's I had Matt Olson that did... the cover for the Geek Girl collection, and also did the sort of famous Geek Girl Wants You picture that I've used very, very much. He's done a limited print of Harley Quinn and Geek Girl smashing up robots, which looks really cool. So we've got some collector's packs of Geek Girl up now, and that comes, this limited edition, limited to only 100 copies of these, and this comes free with the collector's packs. So that's going down well. So it's all going well.
Now, my understanding is that you've already met your goal, haven't you?
Yeah, I mean, as I say, I wasn't using Kickstarter in the traditional sense. We weren't like doing it to fund getting the book done or anything like that. It was already done. The thing really was, as I say, just rather than me sort of guessing how many copies to personally order, I put it up for pre-orders. So the goal was set low, but yeah, we hit that in about 3 days, and it's continuing. And as I say, we're building it from there, putting more things on it, and it's fun.
Now's a good time to be involved, though, because now you get all those goodies you were talking about. Not only do you get the book, but you get these extras as well, so there's even more incentive for people to get involved in Kickstarter.
Yeah, I mean, there's plenty of stuff up there, because there was limited variant editions of issues 1 to 4 of Geek Girl, so you've got those. There's like a banner poster. Geek Girl Zero, which you basically can't get anywhere except directly from me now. So we've got the Geek Girl Zero, the third printing of that, and also the photo variant with my friend Amy cosplaying as Geek Girl. So there's lots of good stuff up there, and it runs till August the 10th, so not a long time left on it, but still time to get on there.
Yeah, now for people who may not remember what Geek Girl is, or maybe who haven't had a chance to listen to your previous interviews, give us like the TV Guide version of what Geek Girl's about.
Okay, so Geek Girl is Ruby Kay. She's a hot, popular college chick, used to getting what she wants. She overhears Trevor Goldstein and his buddy drunk talking about these super tech glasses Trevor's invented that give the user super strength and flight powers. And because she's a little drunk, she kind of suspends disbelief on this and goes with it and decides she wants them. She beats Trevor and Jeff at a game of strip poker after her and her friend Stacy get them more drunk. So she's kind of landed these things on a whim. And then her friend Summer is kind of pushing it. Summer's into the whole superhero thing, which Ruby isn't so au fait with. Summer's kind of pushing her into, you know, what we as comic readers would sort of expect to do if we gain these powers, and designs her a costume. She's flying around town, doesn't really know what she's doing, chatting to someone on her cell phone, asking if she's doing it right. She's not seeing any crime. And then Lightning Storm, the big gun superhero of where she lives in Maine, gets blasted through this billboard by this mysterious Lightning Storm supervillainess who's come from nowhere. Neon God is hospitalized, and Ruby Kay is kind of forced to step up.
I kind of enjoy the fact you've got 4 issues, and the 4th issue, when was that one released?
Well, the thing came out monthly from November last year, so the final issue came out actually March the 1st.
Okay, now I don't want to spoil anything out of it, but I thought you ended it in a way that made it a kind of a lure for people to want to come back and get more. There were some things that resolved, some things did not, which I always like in a comic. I don't want everything to wrap up in a nice, neat bow, but you had things that are leaning towards the future of Geek Girl. So when I read that, I kind of got the feeling that you've got something in mind for Geek Girl beyond this.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Part of the reason that I signed up with Marcosier, the publisher, is they committed to a second Geek Girl miniseries, irrespective of, you know, at that time we didn't know how the first one would do. So this is a characters and this is a universe that I'm invested in. And my plan is, I mean, this, very pleased to say that Carlos Granda, the artist on the first miniseries, is on board for the second one. He's working on something, another project at the moment. So he won't be able to get on that sort of full time until sometime next year. But the scripts for the first two of the four issues are done. I'm very pleased with them. As you say, the way things end in the miniseries, you're not really going to be able to predict where we come in on the second and where things go with it. But got very big plans for Geek Girl and her universe. And the intention is, after we've done the two miniseries and the collections of both, that there will be enough of an audience built up that we can make the third series an ongoing.
That'd be nice. Now, talk about the reception of Geek Girl, because you've been working on this project for a while now, and I know you've been steadily building an audience. Do you want to talk a little bit about how the reception's gone? I mean, you know, you've got that one, you were talking about the photo cover of the lady who can dress up like Geek Girl. Not everybody can. Gratefully, she does it real well. How has the reception gone over time? You've been pleased by how people have liked the series?
Yeah, it's certainly building. I mean, I am spending full time on it one way or another, primarily in promoting the Kickstarter. There's a Facebook group and we're over 19,000 members in that, and that's regularly posting that, so that's a good thing to join. I've been building up the mailing list. If you go to geekgirlcomics.com, there's the first on the sort of landing page. If you can sign up for the mailing list and get a free digital preview comic of Geek Girl, and then you also get notifications of things like this Harley and Geek Girl print. So yeah, it's going well. It's been well received. People generally get it. I have occasionally, and this is more back in the day of Geek Girl Zero, had a little resilience in people sort of expecting one thing and it being another, because the whole character arc of Ruby Kay is, she, as we meet her, she's, you know, a sort of college it girl. She's not a geek, but the glasses are affecting her and will affect her in a number of ways. So where she starts, where she starts at the beginning of the miniseries and who she is at the end of it are quite different, because she's used to being quite self-centered and having what she wants on a plate, and she's not used to putting herself in danger or necessarily helping others. And that's kind of the position she's put in at the beginning of issue one, because of Neon Girl being taken off the map. There's only like two resident superheroes where Ruby lives in Maine, the other one being Pitbull, the jock superhero, and he doesn't last long either, partly thanks to Ruby in issue one. But it's Geek Girl is a flip. As I always say, that the traditional nerd becomes cool superhero. This is cool person, or cool kid, if you like, becomes sort of uncool superhero, but it kind of makes geeky cool and that kind of thing. But yeah, her character going in, not geek, but where she's going, she's changing.
I mean, see, I'm fascinated by the fact that people seem to be taking to this character. You're kind of going a reverse flow, you know. The person who doesn't want the powers gets them and has to deal with them, which most people in comics, they get the powers because they're seeking them for some reason, and then they get them, and then, of course, they're living with them very well because that's what they really want. It's fun to watch her go a different direction in the books.
Yeah, I mean, the big sort of catalyst of becoming Geek Girl, but the spark of her starting to use these powers is, you know, she hangs out with these too cool for school girlfriends, and when she's trying to impress them all and demonstrate these powers, which they're all very dubious and skeptical of, all she ends up doing is knocking drinks over them, and which has an alienating effect. So again, she instantly goes from being, you know, Miss popular to not so much, and Summer, her best friend, is the one that sticks by her and is behind her, and Summer is an integral part of the miniseries. She's kind of not always with her, but they stay in touch on the cell phone, and for the climax that we build to, where you've got Ruby versus Lightning Storm, Summer even manages to get involved in that. So Summer's absolutely got her back.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of like a Batman Beyond setup, where Bruce Wayne was talking to Terry McGinnis when he's out in the suit, and she kind of performs that function in some levels because she understands the superhero world more than Ruby Kay does.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a thing in issue two is kind of a big character thing, and Summer really helps Ruby get her head around the whole superhero thing. And then by issue three, we've got her actually sort of taking hold of this idea of us being a superhero. And after the beginning of that issue, where she's taken out a couple of sort of D-list villains, A-game comprised of Monsieur A and A-Juan, she's like, Summer's been listening in on her cell phone, and Ruby's like asking her how her superhero banter was. So it's a great relationship, and it's kind of strengthened by the fact that they were friends with all this bunch of other girls who were perhaps to varying degrees not as nice as Summer is, and Ruby's kind of alienated from them now. So Summer becomes a bigger part of her life, but she also meets, kind of ironically for Trevor, the guy who came up with these glasses, he did so to impress this waitress, Mariella, who was crushing on, and he didn't feel he could, her boyfriend was, you know, kind of buff and all that, and he didn't feel he could compete, so he thought, oh, well, you know, making myself into a superhero, she's going to go for that. And then obviously Ruby's ended up with these glasses and has somehow actually, or through the course of the mini, ends up becoming friends with Mariella, the waitress, which Trevor and his pal Jeff are aware of, and Jeff kind of rubs in. And Trevor is not crazy about this and maybe starts to rethink about whether he gave these glasses away too easily.
Mm-hmm. I have to say, I don't think we've seen the end of those two guys.
Yeah, well, I mean, you things build with them to issue four, mm-hmm. Where everything comes together. But yeah, I mean, there's certainly potential for more. And I mean, you know, all the ones that aren't dead by the end of it, all of the characters introduced, such as Nina Dante, the sort of slightly unhinged alt girl that takes a liking to Ruby in issue two. I've already got things going on with her in the second miniseries, and we're not done with her, and we're not done with Pitbull, and we're not done with Neon Girl. So yeah, these are characters I'm invested in, and I want to see more of myself.
Now, I've got a question, because you know I've talked about women characters in comics and how groundbreaking I think it is that Geek Girl features these women so prominently, and the men are kind of more the minor characters, which is a flip. You talk about flipping things. You're flipping regular comics. The thing I'm curious about, if the way that Ruby Kay develops, I almost got a feeling that if these girls that she would normally have hung up with, one of them would have gotten the powers, would they have reacted differently, say, than she did?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in her clique, she's kind of in the middle there. She could go one way or another. You've got Summer as the really good person, and then Ruby in the middle, and then Karen, who's the bitch of the group, the kind of leader of the gang, who's not so nice. They certainly would have done. I mean, the whole superhero thing wouldn't even, I can't imagine, would have even occurred to them. It wouldn't be on the table at all. But something we're going to see as well that will be interesting to play out is where Ruby ends up at the end of the miniseries, as I say, is very different to the antics where she's really not impressing her friends at the start of the miniseries. Now, these girls like to be part of what's popular. So Ruby's in a different place at the end of the miniseries. So we're going to see possibly a new dynamic occurring when we get to the second series.
Because, you know, at some point, especially like in culture now that we have, superheroes are a big deal. I mean, if she becomes popular aside from those girls, let's say she becomes a hero that people take notice of and she gets attention, how are those girls going to react to that? Is that something you're going to explore in the second miniseries?
That's absolutely. That's like a big, I mean, I'd say issue one of that is completely scripted, and that's a very big part of it. I mean, if for those that get to the end of the miniseries, it's kind of ambiguous as to where Ruby's going to be, what state Ruby's going to be in when we get to the second series. So it's actually the first issue of the mini is going to be very much focused on the characters around Ruby. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we'll certainly see that, you know, whereas Ruby thinks she's got superhero powers, all she can do is knock drinks over us, the perception of that versus this girl has now taken on the biggest threat that this city has ever faced in Lightning Storm. You know, that looks a little better from her former girlfriend's perspective.
Because I got to say that, you know, guys are going to take a shine to her because she's now somebody who is a value, let's say. Well, I don't want to get too far into it, but, and I don't know what you've got written, and I'm just kind of guessing, but I would say that, you know, she's going to become popular with a different crowd, and different people are going to like her, and the old group is not going to be quite happy with that.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly going to be a popularity thing. I mean, and something else that's got to be addressed is the whole, through this miniseries, you know, the first miniseries, Geek Girl is not being au fait with the whole superhero thing, and like the Pitbull and Neon Girl don't make a secret of their identities, so she's kind of never really thought through whether she should be keeping this identity a secret. So that's something that's going to come up. But I mean, Ruby before the powers was super popular with the guys. It was kind of the effects and the knock-on effect of losing her female friends that made her less popular, and also how a big part of issue two is, you know, she's carrying herself differently. She looks different when she's wearing these glasses because her confidence is affected by this. So, you know, her body language has gone from confident to not. And then, you know, through her interactions, particularly with Summer and also with Nina Dante in that second issue, she comes out stronger at the end of it. So, you know, she was always a hit with the guys. But, yeah, she may be more of a hit with the guys now.
Well, different guys.
But some guys are going to be intimidated as well, though.
Oh,
some
yeah.
wouldn't be able to deal with this strong woman.
She also might be attracted, or another group of guys might find, like, say, the nerd group amongst us would find her very appealing because, super, like we always say, anything a nerd wants, they want to have superpowers. And here's a person who has gotten them. That's going to make her appealing to a group of guys that she hasn't probably, well, she's probably been appealing to them before, but she's going to have even more appeal to them, it seems to me.
Yeah. I mean, again, I've got to watch how much I get into the second series, but yes.
See, that'll be fun to see how she reacts to that, if that's a circumstance you're going to take her into. Where before she's been, you know, jocks have been around her all the time. When she's guys, they're different
Absolutely.
Guys. It's going to be a very different feel for her, you know. It's just so interesting to me how her character would go. I always, you know, and I'd like to know, you know, in an alternate universe, let's say one of the other girls got the glasses and did it. Like, let's say the nasty one did it. She would not be the same hero or character that Ruby is.
No, I mean, the idea of Karin Carpenter getting them is something I'm fleshing out where we go beyond the second miniseries, and that is something that's occurred to me. I haven't decided whether that's something I want to run with yet, but I certainly know what she would do with those powers, and it wouldn't be saving the city.
See, it would be fun for her to be like, let's say Ruby is the Batman and the other girl is the Joker to her. She gets power similar to her, and the two of them kind of take on each other in that way. And I'm just guessing, like I said. I don't know what you've got planned. But all these things kind of come up when I think about the characters and the situation. There's a lot of story that can be told in the setting that you've put together.
Yeah, absolutely. But, I mean, one thing I'm happy that I feel I've been able to pull off and I want to continue doing to whatever degree is that it's where things have gone have not been predictable. So I guarantee you, you're not going to know where we're going to come in with issue one of series two. So, yes, you could quite easily think, what if Karin, you know, got these? But if I was to go that route, as I say, it is something I've given thought to. I'd want to do something different with it, I think. So at the moment, I know, you know, the second mini is plotted. I've got big plans for the third, which is going to put Ruby, well, I don't even really particularly want to go into that too much because of, you know, the second, you know, we are building the audience for this, and the second has got to do well enough that to justify, you know, what I hope will be a third ongoing series. But there's unpredictable is kind of a watchword with what I've got planned.
So no sidekick, no those kinds of things. She's not going to see her. Now we're talking about another group that her dealing with fellow superheroes, you know, people that have powers. You know, is she going to be seen as a sidekick to people? Or is she going to take on a sidekick at some point? This is all stuff that, you know, you're setting up, and I like to think about.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Pitbull plays a big role when we come back. That's about all I can say in terms of any sort of team up and sidekick status, and it's not quite as clear cut as, oh, now Ruby's his sidekick or something like that. It's not that. But yeah, I mean, the universe that she's in is something I'm interested in, and in, as I say, beyond that, her character developing these other characters and Pitbull, who in the first miniseries is, you know, is this kind of jock, let's go get a brewski and fight crime guy. We're going to see a bit more depth to him as well. I mean, he plays a significant role in the first issue of the second series.
Okay, now you've developed the baddie for the first one and kind of resolved that situation. Now we're getting into the new miniseries. Do you have new obstacles for Ruby to take on when we get to that place?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, where we're going to come in is that Lightning Storm, by the end of the first miniseries, has kind of trashed much of Maine's points of authority, police stations and so forth, so that the police are undermanned and, you know, the superhero community isn't in a good shape. So that kind of leaves things open for all kinds of weird and wonderful villains to come out of the woodwork.
Right. Now, I haven't ever asked you, I don't think, but why Maine? Why set this, the whole universe, basically, that we've seen so far within the Maine in the United States? You being from the UK, I would kind of think you'd set this in the United Kingdom.
No, I mean, American comics is my genre. It's what I read. It's where I set my stuff. As for it being Maine specifically, I researched various places in America as to where to set it online. And what I wanted was a place where it's not too big and it's not too small, so that there is a superhero faction. But it's not like, you know, New York City, where you can't move without bumping into Iron Man and Spider-Man. So that's it. So that, you know, we didn't want this to be a place where, oh my God, what's a superhero? That it is a part of life, but it's a small part. So that Ruby, you know, Ruby is a geek girl, is a big deal there. And the position she's put in is, you know, the whole thing is why she has to do what she has to do, why she has to take on Lightning Storm, is because there are only two other resident superheroes and they get taken down in the first issue. So that puts it on Ruby. And she's scared. I mean, you know, Neon Girl is much better at superheroing, has been at it a lot longer than she has, and has been easily taken down by this lightning storm who no one knows anything about. No one even knows what her agenda is. We don't get that until the fourth issue. And like in issue three, when she comes back into it, like it looks like one thing and then it kind of gets flipped by the end of that issue. So you really don't know what she's trying to do until we get to issue four. Mm-hmm. The main reason, no pun intended, for Maine was also just the general feel of the place and that it's in that sort of ground where it's not too big and not too small to facilitate, you know, this setup that is needed for Ruby to be able to, for us to tell the story that we want to tell with Ruby.
Now, I suddenly got a Galaxy Quest type vibe. And in the sense that you know, this in that movie, there was it was like basically a Star Trek convention going on. And, of course, I was just at San Diego a couple of weeks ago, and so I've got that on the brain. Would she ever I've got to ask in the beginning, are there comic conventions, are there superhero conventions in the Geek Girl universe?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's something that would be, it certainly wouldn't be a big thing in Maine. But again, you know, where things are, it's kind of like it was a two-horse town. It's like we've got one girl superhero, we've got one guy superhero, and it's all very cozy. And like people go drinking with Pitbull, and he's got this huge fan base, but it's kind of Pitbull-centric. And Neon Girl is kind of no nonsense. She's not really got too much time for that. They're kind of quite different in that way. So there's not, you know, a fan base for superheroes, I think, really. You know, Neon Girl has adoration. She has this this deal with this carousel soda, which is actually the sign she gets blasted through as an advert that with her on a billboard. But it's not, because what I'm saying is there's one superhero guy, there's one superhero girl. So it's kind of, they've got their own individual fan bases rather than them in this sort of blanket love of superheroes that you would more likely get in a Marvel universe. So again, things will change with Geek Girl. I mean, you know, things end in a place where things are going to blow up for Geek Girl.
So we won't see her at San Diego Comic Con then?
Well, I mean, she won't be at San Diego Comic Con, but a friend Summer might be more inclined to go to something like that.
So that might be fun if she comes back from San Diego Comic Con and tells Ruby what she saw out there. And give her ideas on what Ruby can do as a superhero.
I mean, you know, she might follow in Neon Girl's footsteps and get some merchandising down, because as it stands, she's studying PR, so that wouldn't be too much of a stress. No. There may be some things to put together there.
Wow, okay. Well, anyway, I'm just throwing ideas out because this is the book prompts all these ideas in me to think about what could happen in these circumstances. So I like that real well. So as far as the Kickstarter goes, how do people get involved in the Kickstarter?
So go to Kickstarter.com and search Geek-Girl, and that'll bring it up. And say it runs till August the 10th. You can pre-order the first collection, which collects issues 1 to 4, and that comes out on August 25th. And then, as I say, there's all kinds of collectibles on there as well, including this really great Harley and Geek Girl smashing up robots print that's done by Matt Olson, which I'm super pleased with how that's turned out. We only just got this done a couple of days ago. It was something, you know, to add during the campaign, and it looks great.
Okay, now before I let you go, can you give us like quick updates on how your other projects are doing? I know right now you're focused on Geek Girl. What about like your other projects? Can you tell us a little bit about how they're going along, or is this keeping you busy right now?
Yeah, I mean, it absolutely is keeping me busy. I mean, for anyone that's done a Kickstarter, it's a full-time gig if you want to get the most out of it. But yeah, the Almighty's, the third Almighty's Afterbirth is gradually is gradually coming along. Everyone involved in that, you know, works on other stuff. Mike teaches, Eleonora teaches, but it's getting done, and we're good way into it. Elio just sent me the ink page 19 today, so there's only about maybe 5-6 more pages of art to do, and then just for the colorists to catch up, and and Mike to do the letters. So yeah, I can't put a date on it, but it's good, and it's, you know, Elio has been the main artist on the first two issues of this. For those that aren't aware of it, it's a comedy super team, pokes fun at like the superhero genre and Marvel big events and so forth. You can still get hold of Zero and one of them. It's at almightisamass.com. So yeah, that's coming on, and then the intention after that comes out would be to do a collection of the three issues. Carbuccini, Voodoo Junkie, Hit Woman being my other one, who so far has made appearances in anthologies and well, in FX, specifically FX Halloween issues, and then there's a free thing that kind of sets up the miniseries called Carbuccini Dark New Year, which you can still get at Drive Through Comics. And that, for a while now, it's, there's just been a few pages left to get done because I added an extra sequence to it. But what I've decided is, with Geek Girl being getting the momentum it is, I plan on Cabra making an appearance in the Geek Girl comic. So what I'm looking to do, it's all being, well, you know, if things pan out the way I'm aiming for them to, would be to not release the Geek Girl, to release the Cabra series until the same sort of time as she's appearing in the Geek Girl series, so that she'll have that exposure. As I say, you can get this Carbuccini Dark New Year now. Chini is spelled C-I-N-I. Which is a good thing. I mean, that previews the miniseries, and it's got its own self-contained story, which really shows what she's about. You know, she's it's a darker thing than Geek Girl. She's an ex-hooker, ex-junkie, who's found a new addiction in this sort of bastardized version of voodoo that she's sort of developed for herself, and has become this supernatural hit woman. It's again a character I'm very invested in. So I just want to give her the best, you know, launch of the mini. And I think, as I say, now planning on her showing up in Geek Girl, I think tying those two together would be a good way to launch it.
Cool. Now, I got to go back to one thing you said. Almighty's Afterbirth. Is that a play on Rebirth?
It certainly is.
Okay.
Yeah, that possibly needs to clarify. I mean, when you see, it's on the logo of it is on the homepage of almightisamass.com, and when you see that, hopefully the way that's put together visually is that that will be apparent, because it's probably best not not too misconstrued. But I mean, that is, you know, the Almighty's is, it's quite edgy, so the feel of that works. So yeah, I mean, I love the title, but obviously if you hear it in isolation, it might get a little head scratching.
Well, when if you're a comics fan, you'll probably know right away what that was. So I think that's pretty cool. So we got until August 10th, and get get you up as high as we can, so everybody can get all the good goodies that you've got, and get the book, which I think Geek Girl is great fun. I think it's, like I said, it puts the human back in superhuman, which is the way I like to describe it. And I can't wait to see what other stuff you've got, Sam. I'm really looking forward to all this stuff being successful.
Thank you, Wayne. And yeah, I mean, the human thing is a big part of it. As I say, these, you know, some reviews have said it's like, particularly in issue 2, which is character centric, that it's kind of like, you know, listen to real people talk, and that's, it's important to me. Yeah, I appreciate that comment. I mean, that's one of the, you know, as you probably know, I've used that on some of the promos for it. And yeah, this is, you know, this is a multi-layered character that I'm looking to, see where things go with.
Okay, we're not going to see a Geek Guy sometime, are we?
Well, it's not out of the question. I mean, it depends what Trevor's up to. Okay. I mean, we get a kind of attempt at that in issue 4 when he tries to get the glasses back, but it's, you know, it's possible. Okay. But Ruby's the focus anyway.
Right. Well, great stuff, Sam. Keep it up. And looking forward to getting ready, for getting into the next miniseries and other things you've got.
Yeah, and another thing to mention about the, you know, the future stuff is, as I mentioned, if you sign up to the mailing list at geekgirlcomics.com, as well as whatever's going on with the current stuff, that'll be where you'll start hearing stuff about the second mini when things start moving with that.
How about following you and your projects and stuff? Facebook, what's the best way to keep up with what you're doing?
I should be. If you've got any friends on Facebook that are into comics, I'm pretty easy to find. Sam Johnson, because you'll probably come up with mutual friends. But I think if you go to the geekgirlcomics.com homepage, that links to most things. Certainly the Geek Girl group, and in the Geek Girl group, you'll see me posting, so you won't have any problem finding me.
Okay. And are you, any hope of writing Deadpool yet?
Well, I've kind of focused on this now. I mean, part of my thing, when we've talked about Deadpool before, was part of the reason I wanted to do it as much as I did at that time was I wasn't getting the Deadpool I wanted. I felt that it wasn't, you weren't getting into the depth of the character. And now under Jerry Duggan, you are. So part of my desire was I wanted to sort of see the Deadpool that I know and love. And that's kind of being done. So I'm quite all right with, I mean, the thing is, I'm not at the level where I could consider, you know, being hired as the ongoing writer for Deadpool, but that's something I'm working towards, so it's still something I really want to do. But at the moment, I'm happy with what Marvel's doing with Deadpool and with what I'm doing with my stuff.
Well, we get the best of both worlds at this point for that, but I think you'll get your chance at some point to do that, so I'm looking forward to that.
Well, yeah, thank you. I mean, that is my, you know, if I can pick a character I want to work on that's not one of my own characters, then Deadpool's the one I go for sure.
Well, keep at it, and I'm sure you get your chance, and looking forward to this being, it's already a success, we don't have to worry about that, but even more successful as you get to the end of the Kickstarter and things in the future.
Thank you very much, Wayne.
And that's it for this episode. Be back next week when I'll have another great interview with another wonderful comics creator. But until then, keep reading your comics.